I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about some pressing needs for Indiana, early childhood education, and the ways Hoosiers can get information about needed services. We'll discuss how government and charities are working together to meet these challenges. My guests will be John Barth, the Vice President of the Indianapolis-Marion County Council, Andrew Cullen, Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana, and Ryan Brady, Philanthropic Advisor to the Glick Fund and the Glick Family Foundation. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about some community needs in central Indiana and actually throughout the state, early childhood education and Indiana's 211 resource and referral system. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are sort of approaching meeting these challenges from different points on the continuum, starting with Andrew Cullen, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana, John Barth, who is the Vice President of the Indianapolis-Marion County Council, and Ryan Brady, who has many titles, but today he is the Philanthropic Advisor to the Glick Fund and the Glick Family Foundation. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you
here.
Thanks,
John.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's start with early childhood education and talk about, there's a pilot out there right now that has achieved some success. Can we talk? I'll start with you, Andrew, on this one. Can we talk about what the pilot program is, what we're trying to accomplish with it?
Sure. Thank you, John, again, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. The pilot program was established under state law in the previous legislative session to provide high-quality early childhood education opportunities for children in select counties. There were 18 counties in the state of Indiana that were originally selected by the state to apply. All 18 did apply. Five were selected. Marion County was one of the counties that was selected. In a co-effort with Mayor Ballard's office, United Way of Central Indiana's CEO, Ann Mertlow, signed a statement of county readiness telling the state that Marion County wanted to participate and providing them with all the information they needed to make sure that the dollars the state was going to invest would be invested in a wise way. As a result, we have been involved in marketing this program for the last 6 or 8 months, and we have our first cohort of children who are now this week starting pre-K in levels 3 and 4 providers or those that are nationally accredited, which are the highest quality of child care providers. They're 4-year-olds from lower-income families below 127% of poverty. The state is paying 90% of their tuition, and 10% is being paid by a matching grant secured by United Way of Central Indiana. And I'm happy also to thank Councilor Barth and the city for actually appropriating $100,000, which covered the entire matching grant for this first cohort of children. So we're really excited to see this program underway, and we're looking forward to fantastic results for Marion County's children.
Councilor Barth, how many children are we talking about in this pilot?
Well, there's something to clarify, in that there's two pilots here, or two programs. Actually, one is the state's pilot that Andrew was speaking of, and with the funding from the city, there's a total of 500 kids that will be served right off the beginning of this year. But secondarily, the council passed a proposal back in December that creates our own Indianapolis pre-K program. So it will build where the state has launched a pilot program that's going to be live in 2015. The city is going to have its own 5-year plan that's going to serve about 1,000, between 1,000 and 1,300 kids a year. So over 5,000 kids will be served across 5 years, starting this fall or early next year in the Indianapolis pre-K program. So there's actually two programs, one created and run by the city.
Now, the statewide program reaches about, that originally was intended to go to 350 kids, right, the pilot, and the five counties, just to be, I know we're broadcasting from Marion County, but we actually reach other parts of the state as well, including some of the counties that are affected. Lake County, right, Allen, Vanderburg, and Jackson, right, is the last one. How do we arrive in, actually, that 350 number expanded, right, Ryan?
That's correct, yes.
So what are we at now?
Andrew, do you know the exact number?
I believe we're around 500. We had overwhelming number of families that applied, and we were not able to serve all the families, which makes the city's program even more critical. We knew that there was a need out there, and this very first effort to try to achieve a certain number, which was 350 at the time, mm-hmm. showed us that is far too few, and that the need is much greater than that. So the state was able to bump up that number somewhat. I don't know that we have a final number yet, because it will depend on enrollment and who actually showed up for class, probably yesterday or today.
Mm-hmm. How did they go about selecting the students who were going to be involved? Since obviously it sounds like. Even is it correct, Counselor Barth, to say that with the city's add-on, Indianapolis's add-on, the combination of the two pilot programs here is probably more expansive. That's with an A, not expensive, but expansive than in any other place in the state. Or am I in error?
No, that's absolutely true. With the support that the council put forward and the mayor, alongside the wonderful support we have from Eli Lilly and a lot of corporate partners, including MS Communications and Anthem and many others, we're going to be able to serve a lot more children and go a lot deeper in making sure that families, especially families at the lower levels of poverty, have a route and a pathway to education.
How did we choose the students? Who are going to be involved?
How the Indianapolis pre-K program works is similar to how the state works, in that there's an application process based on your federal poverty level. And then what we did at the city level is built it on a three-tier approach. So starting at 127% of poverty, families at that level will be prioritized. If there's not enough children who come to be served at that level, it'll go up to 138 and then again up to 185% of FPL. But I do think we know that there's well over 10,000 children in the city who have the need or who are living at that level of poverty. So I feel confident, especially based on the early success that the state's program has had, that we're going to have far more need than we have slots for kids.
And when we talk about 127% of poverty, I mean, what is the household income we're talking about?
That's about $30,000 for a year for a family of four.
Okay, so anything under 30K for the household income of a family of four, and you probably qualify.
Yeah, I think one nuance that's important from a philanthropic aspect that kind of on behalf of mm-hmm. families like the Glick family and other philanthropists look at is, are we going to get a good return on investment out of this if we invest private dollars? And I think what's exciting, and really United Way has been leading this along with Councillor Barth, and it's great to see that kind of private-public partnership, is these are families and children that would not otherwise be served by existing pre-K programs, whether that's child care vouchers or other programs. So these are kids that really would not otherwise have access. From a philanthropic standpoint, that's the area where we're really looking at is a private or public intervention would really do something that would not otherwise be done, and that's what's exciting about both the state's pilot program and the city's pre-K program.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about some of the pressing needs confronting Indiana and how government and charitable organizations are working together to meet them. We're talking right now about early childhood education. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Why? We probably ought to take a step back on this. We're talking about all of the things we're doing to try to foster early childhood education. Why is this so important? Why is this the priority that it is? Ryan, I'll start with you.
Yeah, that's a great question, John. And I think it's healthy for a community to really ask that question. And you kind of have to any program that involves investment or effort, we should look at that from a critical lens. And certainly from Central Indiana Community Foundation's perspective, from the Glick Family Foundation's perspective, and many philanthropist perspectives, it's really come down to is there a return for any kind of investment, whether that's public or private. I think the case statement through research over decades in throughout the country has proven that investment in early childhood education results in a great return. The return on investment for every dollar spent on high quality early childhood education ranges from about a $4 to $9 return in either cost saved down the road through the lack of having to go back and do remediation with kids, to also increased earnings for those children again. There certainly has been question about that at the Head Start level. And I think one nuance that we have to look at is with any program is often we're looking at returns maybe a little bit too early in the children's life who go through pre-K. For example, there's been questions about Head Start that the return may not be there when you look at third grade scores. Well, often if you go further down the road and look at how are those kids that had access to high quality pre-K, how are they doing when they're in high school and beyond, that's really when you're seeing the returns. And I think that's
I'm probably taking us down a side path here, but at some level, how do they determine that? I mean, to some degree, it sounds almost like proving a negative. If you see what I'm saying, that if they hadn't had this, they would have been doing that. I mean, you're sort of stuck with where you are.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, unfortunately, there are plenty of kids who don't have access to high-quality education, so you've got a big control group.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think you're comparing results from children from similar backgrounds to see what their longer-term results are. And the overwhelming evidence that's been proven over and over again is that children who have access to high-quality, and the key is high-quality, early childhood education both demonstrate increased positive attributes, increased earnings, higher graduation rates, and decreased negative attributes, lower reduction in crime, lower reduction in substance abuse. When we look at it from a philanthropic perspective, it's one of the strongest case statements that out there for investment.
Councillor Barth, it was not effortless for the city to come to its early childhood pilot. What were the issues and the challenges there? Because some of this sounds almost self-evident, but as I say, it was not an easy march to get to this point.
No, it wasn't. It was a significant challenge for a lot of reasons. And if you look at the totality of the concerns that councilors had, there are some very legitimate concerns. And the one that was the most resonant with me was the fact that a lot of councilors stated they didn't think it was the city's job to provide education. It's really a state issue, and it's an issue where legislators should be leading. I don't disagree with that. My comment in response was, well, there's been 100-plus meetings of the Indiana General Assembly, and to date we've had one small pilot. We have a serious problem in Indianapolis, and it is that we have about a third of our children living in poverty, and it's only gotten worse in the last 10 years or so. That's an awful situation to face, especially as someone like me who represents the entire county. I don't want to go out to my constituents and say, I know there's a terrible problem with poverty, and I haven't done anything about it. And counselors started to realize, yeah, that's true. We do have a problem with poverty. It's not going to get better unless we take action. And one of the things we believed as a council, the proposal passed by 19 votes, was that something we can do as a council, if we can support early childhood education, we can put families, especially families who are most vulnerable, put their children on a pathway to a better life by giving them access to education as early as possible. And that's ultimately the argument, the correct one, that won out.
Is there a motivation? I'm going to stick with you, Councillor Barth, and we've got about a minute here. Obviously, as a pilot, the presumption is that you're testing something here. Is there, and you've already indicated that you think the need is going to far outstrip the available slots for all of this. Is there a hope that this will be just extended across the table?
Yet one of the reason why we built the proposal the way we did in partnership with Eli Lilly and the mayor's office, other counselors, and other entities that have donated money was with the vision that that would give us 5 years. It would give clarity of purpose, clarity for families that this is a program that has a time limit, and then we can work with the General Assembly to sort of prove this is working and this matters, and hopefully get the support for a program for Marion County and statewide, starting at the 5-year endpoint and going on forward for every Hoosier child.
We are talking, and that actually will be next subject conversation when we come back. We are talking about prevailing community needs in Indiana this year. My guests are Andrew Cullen, who is with United Way, John Barth, who is an Indianapolis Marion County counselor, and Ryan Brady. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about prevailing community needs here in Indiana. We've been focusing on talking about early childhood education so far, and we're going to continue that. Talking with Andrew Cullen, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana, John Barth, who is the Vice President of the City County Council here in Indianapolis, Marion County, and Ryan Brady, who is the Philanthropic Advisor to the Glick Fund and the Glick Family Foundation. Well, just before the break, we were talking about, you know, the possibilities of expanding this in Marion County. Obviously, if the, 5,000 spots over 5 years, if I remember the math right, isn't going to come anywhere close to meeting the need here in Indianapolis and Marion County, I think we can assume that the 500 through the state, the only five counties in the state, is going to come even less close. What are sort of the next steps for expanding this, if it's going to be expanded, and what are the things we are testing with this pilot? Andrew, I'll start with you.
Well, what I have heard at the General Assembly this session is basically what the governor has said and legislative leaders is that they truly do want to give this pilot an opportunity to prove results before they expand it. So no, none of the leaders or the governor have proposed in this particular budget year a expansion of early childhood education other than a continuation of the pilot program to the tune of $10 million per year. I have heard discussions that there may be a mechanism placed in the school funding formula to potentially fund early childhood education in the future, even though it may not be funded in the upcoming biennial. There may be some sort of a mechanism looked at that could possibly be put in place in the future. So I think we still have a ways to go at the state level. We still have a lot of legislators who aren't convinced, but I'm actually convinced that once the city's program takes off, and I'm convinced it's going to be a success, other legislators from throughout the state are going to look at Indianapolis as a model and say, why not us?
And this takes me to another point. And when we're talking about early child education and the way it's kind of reshaped the discussion and the debate about not just about this subject of early childhood education, but also the ways we make decisions as a community and as a state, because in some ways, what has happened here is that the no offense to Councillor Barth, but the perception was that anything that involves a new expense, government is loath to look at right now, and in many ways, what happened here is that corporate and philanthropic dollars stepped up to sort of work as the triggering mechanism on this to jumpstart the discussion, at least here in Indianapolis. We had Michael Huber of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce on who a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, in effect, that the perception of the business community, you know, response to government programs was, if it's a tax, we don't like it, is now outdated, that it's more what Ryan is saying about we're looking at return on investment, we're not adverse to paying more taxes if we see that something's coming back out of it. Andrew, could you talk a little bit about the corporate involvement in pushing this thing forward?
Well, I mean, I would defer to Councillor Barth on this, but I would argue that I think the corporate involvement had a lot to do with the council's action. Certainly, Dr. Lechleiter at Lilly, under the leadership of Rob Smith, stepped up to the plate in a big way to say that Lilly would lead the corporate community in an effort to raise $10 million. We have money from committed. Anthem has committed $1 million. Citizens Energy, Community Health, Cummins has committed $1 million. MS Communication, IPL, IU Health has committed $1 million. Key Bank, Lilly itself is contributing $2 million. PNC, Thompson Distribution, and Walker have already stepped up to the plate and said, as long as the council acts and passes the fiscal ordinance, which we can't forget, there still is one final step in this process that the council under Councillor Barth's leadership will be considering one final ordinance, which is the fiscal ordinance. As long as that ordinance passes, we have the corporate community under Lilly's leadership has $6.1 million worth of pledges that will immediately go into this program as well.
How critical is that, since Andrew sort of set you up there, Councillor Barth?
Is the fiscal?
Yeah, well, and how much of this was pushed by corporate philanthropic community?
That's really been wonderful about the experience of moving this proposal forward has been the nexus, the coming together of the corporate community, folks who are involved in the political world, and the nonprofit community working together. And I think that really demonstrates that the issue itself is a thing that pulls people together and drives it forward. As far as how critical was the corporate involvement is very critical. I can tell you the political side at some times got to be a little heated, and it was really the leadership of Eli Lilly and those of us working together, where we all came together sitting in a conference room down at Lilly's campus and talking things through. They provided the opportunity of being a neutral convener where we could kind of work things through, and that's really the point at which we pulled out the budget and started going through it line by line by line, saying, okay, this is a priority for us, and we all know the budget is nothing but a set of priorities. So let's go through and rebalance this budget and find the priorities to invest in our kids.
We are talking about some significant community needs here in Indiana on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Ryan, is this in some ways a new kind of model for, you know, public decision making now?
I actually think this example of the city taking leadership on pre-K builds off of Indianapolis's best tradition of private and public collaboration. I mean, we can run through the list of great projects, from hosting a Super Bowl doesn't happen without corporate support, but also leadership of the city. I think the Cultural Trail is another example that's been transformative to the city. Again, another public-private partnership. It's what excites, I think, many of us in the community is that this is an example that really deals with youth and the future generation. I think when you see the private philanthropic community and the for-profit communities stepping up and holding leadership accountable to elected officials accountable to kind of doing what's right for the best interest of the community long term, that means something. I would tip my hat to United Way's leadership. I think United Way created the conditions to give the private philanthropic and private for-profit community the confidence that if we were to expand pre-K, that the quality would be there. Through the Paths to Quality program that United Way of Central Indiana has been leading for many years in collaboration with many providers out there, they created the conditions that if we were to expand the program, that we would have providers that would be able to get that social return on investment. So it's been, I think, in the best tradition of Indianapolis public-private partnerships.
Are there any dangers? I mean, one of for a long time, the concern about public-private partnerships to some degree has been that the private part driving what is public policy, that Councillor Barth is accountable to the voters, but all due respect to Ryan and Andrew, neither one of you is ultimately. You have other employers, as it were. Is that a concern at all, Councillor Barth?
Just the level of accountability back to the partners, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about public-private partnerships sort of in the government realm, there's a whole strata of how they work and how they operate and how influence happens. And the Justice Center is a perfect example of a current debate of something that's a public-private partnership that's very
different. That's another show.
Very different. And this, to me, what I've noticed in the political realm is that there's far too much of the far left and the far right, too many people yelling at each other. What I've tried to do on the council is bring people together and find sort of the sensible center, and I have this concept of sort of nonpartisan policy corridors, areas where you need to put politics at the side and focus on policies that matter for people of the city. I think transportation is a great example. I think the Eskenazi building that is another wonderful example. And to me, I put this in that same category of sort of a nonpartisan policy corridor where we can all sit in the same room and say, whether you're coming from the corporate community, the nonprofit community, the political realm, we all agree we need to do more and do better for our kids, and let's put the politics aside. So at the end of the day, it is the politicians, the elected officials, who have to put it forward and designate public funds. And so there is accountability there. There's no doubt about it. And if that doesn't work, if there's accountability for those politicians, the folks in the corporate and the nonprofit side will experience that their friends are no longer there to help them. So there is ultimately some kind of accountability, I think, for the process, right? The process has to work, and a citizen will express if they liked the process or they didn't when it comes to Election Day 2015.
We are talking about ways that that government and largely charitable organizations are working together to meet prevailing community needs. Specifically, we've been talking about early childhood education. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Nina, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, we're here.
I was trying to figure out how much power do corporations have in our school systems now that they're giving money to them?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call and the question. We'll try to get an answer for you. Thanks. Well, that's a variation, actually, of the question I asked just before, too, which is the degree of influence. Is this a concern that, and you hear it now, that particularly when we're talking about public education, the corporatization of public education, and particularly, this doesn't apply to the two of you, but having some for-profit entities involved seems to have raised concerns in quarters. Is this something people need to worry about? Ryan, I know it's a tough one, but I'm going to throw it to you.
Yeah, no, I think it's I think the caller's question is absolutely appropriate and fair, and we always need to be looking at what are the motivations. But I think from what we try to do at Central Indiana Community Foundation, what we try to do with the Glick Family Foundation, is really look at what the ultimate return is. So whether that is, in this case, and when it comes to pre-K, what we're talking about, mm-hmm. The program, the operators, the providers of the pre-K programs have to be not – majority of counselors, is it all not-for-profit providers? Or it could be for-profit or not-for-profit. So it comes down to – Are the children getting the results? If a for-profit provider can do that in a cost-effective manner and attain the results, so that's great. It creates a competitive marketplace. I think anytime we have a competitive marketplace dealing with anything related to education, it's probably for the better. We do need to have regulation and oversight to make sure that quality is there. But from a philanthropic investment standpoint, we're focused on ultimately on what the results are for the, in this case, for our young children.
Andrew, you look like you want to jump in on this.
Well, I would just say that, you know, the caller's question, of course, is valid, but this is a public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So in this particular case, the public side is the one setting the parameters for how this program works. There's no question about that. So the donors from the public sector or the private sector are actually saying that we agree with the way this program is being set up by your public officials and we want to support it. But the caller should be clear that the parameters of the program are still set by their elected officials.
By government. We've got an email comment from a listener named Michael, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. He starts out saying, an old joke. The questions parents are asked when they arrive to enroll their child in the early childhood education program is, do you want the pre-engineering, pre-law, or pre-med preschool program? It's actually not a joke when early childhood education is designed to be a high school for small children. It's also funny to see a pilot when kindergarten in the U.S. started in the 1860s and preschools have been around for more than 60 years, especially for the wealthy, which I think raises a whole nother question, which is, you know, isn't some of this catch up on the part of the state of Indiana that we're trying to close some ground that where other states are ahead of us? Ryan, you're nodding your head the most emphatically, so I'm going to go with you first.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, from a research perspective and from a data perspective, we know that brain development happens during those first 5 years of a child's life. Investing in that time yields tremendous results. I know I'm kind of saying that over and over again. So, you know, I think, again, parents are a huge part of this equation. The community engagement is a huge part of this equation. But formal education and a pre-K experience for those parents who choose to enroll. This is not a required program, but parents who elect to do this, we want to ensure that every parent ultimately has the choice, if that makes sense for that family, to have access to high quality pre-K. Because we know it's such a critical time in a child's life.
How much of this, though, and I want to take that point. I mean, in terms of Indianapolis's attractiveness as a place for businesses to locate, for talent to locate, for, you know, it to be a thriving environment, how important is sort of solving the early childhood education problem to the city's development, Councilor Barth?
I think it's critically important. I think having citizens who have access to early childhood education is really a cornerstone for the future of the city. I think, to me, how we ultimately got this passed, as I mentioned earlier, we are able to do it by focusing the program on the families in the city who are the most vulnerable, who have the least access to early childhood education. And the thing that really struck me about it was when I happen to have a daughter myself who's in pre-K named Beatrice, and during this whole process I would take her and drop her off at a high quality pre-K where she attends, and there are times when it got really rough and I would be thinking it wouldn't happen, but I'd be in this pre-K and I would see all these parents rolling in and dropping their kids off, hustling off to work, and to your point earlier, mm-hmm. there are a lot of families who could afford it, who are making mm-hmm. sure that their kids had a pathway to be successful in life. And it really started to hit me that there's far too many kids in Indianapolis who don't have that early opportunity to have this pathway for success. Far too many families who want to provide it but can't. And so if our city is going to be successful going into the future, we need to make sure that every kid has the opportunity. And so we focus the program to make sure the families who are most vulnerable also have that opportunity to get their kids early childhood education, and that will benefit the city in the long term.
And how many do we have numbers on, we've got the two pilots as we're talking about, the one here in the city and then the statewide one. I think, Councilor Barth, you'd mentioned that there are roughly 10,000 children who will fit that criteria in the next few years, right?
The number that's ringing a bell from a couple of months ago was that of the 127% federal poverty, there were approximately 10,000, maybe a little bit more, kids who would be eligible in that strata.
And do we have any idea how many there are across the state of Indiana? Andrew? Ryan?
I don't know that.
Yeah. So, but we can assume that. Do we have any idea whether the challenges are greater, in urban settings or, rural poverty is something that's often overlooked and not discussed. We know if this is a larger urban problem or a larger rural, or if it's even across the board.
I can't speak directly to the statewideness of the issue, but I can speak directly to the citywideness of the issue. And something that's really striking during the development process, we put together a map that showed where kids would be impacted across the city. And the truth is, all across Marion County, there are depths of poverty that need to be addressed, not just in places you think the poverty is.
We are talking about some community challenges here in Indiana on No Limits. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about some critical needs facing Indiana right now and the ways that charitable organizations and government are working together to meet them. My guests are Andrew Cullen, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana, John Barth, who is the Vice President of the Indianapolis-Marion County Council, and Ryan Brady, who is the Philanthropic Advisor to the Glick Fund and the Glick Family Foundation. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Miles, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I was since Governor Pence refused $80 million in pre-K federal money, I was wondering what effect that has on the pre-K funding, and positive or negative, and why that was refused by the governor. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Ryan, I'll start with you on that one.
You know, I don't know the details specifically of why the governor's administration decided not to pursue. I do think from the perspective of expanding pre-K to kids in need, we need all resources possible. I think expecting the philanthropic sector to do that exclusively is not realistic. I think we have a bipartisan administration in Indiana, or a bipartisan coalition in Indianapolis, led by Councilor Barth and Mayor Ballard. I think we've demonstrated that that kids are an issue that we can work on together.
Andrew, you are nodding your head.
Well, I would just say that, I think it's unfair to say the governor turned down $80 million. The governor decided not to pursue a potential grant from the federal government. Governor Pence has been extremely supportive of the concepts of creating a solid, high-quality pre-K program in the state of Indiana. And were it not for him, we would not have the pilot, Indiana's first ever funding of individual vouchers for needy children. So I think it's important that we remember that.
We have spent most of our time talking, obviously, about early childhood education because it is a priority and there's a lot of energy in that area right now. But, you know, one of the other things, partnership, has been the 2-1-1 resource and referral system. First, could we get a description of what that would be? Andrew, I'll start with you on that one.
Oh, sure. I appreciate you bringing that topic up. United Way of Central Indiana, we have been supporting Indiana's Central Indiana version of 2-1-1 for many, many years. It's called Connect to Help. And pretty much, I mean, every hour of every day, people need essential human services. They're looking for health care assistance, help with prenatal care, domestic abuse support, counseling, ways to improve their economic situation. And 2-1-1 is basically a service that allows Indiana residents to, you know, get the critical help they need and so they can lead safe and healthy lives. And ultimately, last year alone, in fact, 1 in 10 Hoosiers called 2-1-1 on their pathway to self-sufficiency. And, you know, government agencies are consistently using 2-1-1 as a backbone service, such as the Department of Health, which I believe is about to announce an infant mortality program, and 2-1-1 will be critical to that. FSA uses it widely for their services. And 911 regularly actually transfers calls over to 2-1-1. And so, you know, with great support from the Glick Fund, this year, United Way of Central Indiana is leading an effort to communicate with the General Assembly about the importance of this work and to help them understand that it is completely funded by philanthropic dollars. So it is essentially a basic government service that the philanthropic sector continues to support year after year after year, and it continues to grow and grow and grow. And the philanthropic sector is asked for more every single year. And truthfully, at the end of the day, it is time that the state government step up and recognize that they have a role to play here and become a partner in this effort. And so we've been really excited to have State Senator Jim Merritt from here in Indianapolis supporting this legislation in a press conference that he had the other day, along with State Representative Greg Porter from here in Indianapolis, who is very supportive, as well as House Majority Floor Leader Judd McMillan and the Senate Finance Committee Ranking Minority Member Karen Talion. We also had the Attorney General attend the press conference to indicate his belief that this is critically important because of the work that 211 does in disaster response. It refers Hoosiers to critical disaster-related goods and services. It connects volunteers to disaster relief operations and serves as a sentinel for public information needs. And so in addition to helping veterans, seniors, infant mortality, health care, domestic abuse, and disaster response, 211 just effectively gives Hoosiers in need the help they have to have in order to become self-sufficient. It is a critical service, and we will be making every effort this year for the State General Assembly to support it.
Ryan, I'm going to ask you, since obviously the Glick Foundation is pouring a lot of the weight, of funding this. One, first question is, why has it been a priority? And the second is, how close is the demand for those services to outstripping even the Glick Fund or the Glick Foundation's capacity to meet that need?
Yeah, it's, kind of tying back into our earlier conversation about pre-K. Let's kind of imagine yourself, and probably many listeners can maybe in this situation or can imagine this. If you're a parent looking for a high-quality pre-K program, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And fill in the blank. If you're a veteran who's in need of counseling, if you're a senior who's looking for whose heat is not working, if you're a teen looking for an after-school program, like, who do you call? Like, where do you turn? It's incredibly complicated to figure that out. On the other side, if you're if you want to make a difference and get personally involved as a volunteer, who do you call? Mm-hmm. So the answer is 211. And essentially, many donors, including the Glick Family Foundation and the Glick Fund, have contributed to 211 because it's just a really efficient way to get information and referrals to individuals who want to help and individuals who may need help.
How large is the funding? I'm sorry to interrupt, but
yeah,
how much is the Glick Family Fund and Family Foundation contributing to do this? I mean, what's the price tag for
Yes, so the price tag statewide to provide the level of service that's being provided right now is about $3.5 million. That's almost exclusively being supported by philanthropic resources. So locally, the Glick Fund has invested about $400,000 in the past couple of years to support really focusing on central Indiana. And then how do we think about this more holistically as a state?
Okay. We are talking about pressing community needs that charitable organizations and government are working together to meet here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I was wondering whether or not the pre-K program for children who are 4 years old, whether or not this is nothing more than a child care program versus an educational program. And who are the teachers, if it is an educational program, who are going to be taking care of the children?
Very good question. Thank you very much for the call and the question, Barbara. Ryan, we'll let you take that one.
Yeah, it's definitely not child care. So to qualify for the program, teachers have to have a degree in education or degree in early childhood education. It is through the PASD Equality Program. Programs are evaluated both for safety of the children, but really are children learning in a way that they would not otherwise be learning without this program. So it's rigorous, high-quality education. That's, again, from a philanthropic perspective, that's what we're holding providers accountable for, is that they get those childhood outcomes, that return on investment.
That question obviously, education here in Indiana has become, you know, perhaps the most volatile and highly energized public debate now that, you know, same-sex marriage is sort of in the rearview window and a mirror, and the right to work battles. Is there any hope out of all of this that we're going to be able to cut through kind of the layers of distrust and animosity on both sides of that debate? Councillor Barth, I'll start with you, since as public officials are pretty much the ones who are caught in the crossfire there.
Well, I mean, I hope so. I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If public officials, if elected officials start taking the position that we're not going to take this from the right, we're not going to take this from the left, we're going to take on an issue of coming at it from a perspective of how can we do it from a nonpartisan policy corridor, how can we look at an issue based on what's right for citizens of Indianapolis, what's right for Hoosiers, and what gets us the best results, then I think everybody wins. Sometimes it's hard to get there, and people have very strong opinions on education, and so doing that can be hard, especially in the legislative arena. And that's why it's really important to have forums like this and forums where citizens are coming and speaking their mind so there's a nuanced perspective. It can happen. It takes a lot of leadership, and it takes a lot of time. And so getting those informed public policy debates are something that's worth the effort to do right.
Getting an email from a listener named Kenny, who says the vast majority of 20th century U.S. leaders in jurisprudence, business, politics, technology, the arts, etc., attended the early mid-century public schools of America. Thank goodness they, as children, were never subjected to the unseemly decisions to sort and select children with vouchers, charters, and other mechanisms to solidify privileges of the upper economic strata. This country had a commitment to every child receiving a quality, free, publicly funded education. It is an obscenity and is undermining our nation that public education has been decimated in favor of defective models of privatization. Who gains from this? Certainly not the children, who aren't smiled down upon by philanthropists, charter school entrepreneurs, and voucher-wielding politicians. There's not really a question in there, so I'm going to take one, reframe one. And I'm not belittling you, Kenny. I know the point you're trying to make, but I'm going to try to reframe it so we get a discussion. Ryan and Andrew, I mean, how much of this is philanthropic organizations trying to drive the process, and how much of it is possibly that government has to some degree backed away from its commitment to providing quality education to all young people, and philanthropic organizations have felt the need to step in and meet that gap? I'll start first with Andrew. I know it's a tough question.
It is a tough question because it's a tough issue, John. We all have opinions about how best to educate our children for the future. And it is, I think that there are genuinely good people on almost all sides of this debate who, as Councillor Barth mentioned, you know, are best when they come to the table and have open discussions about the best policies. I've only worked in education policy now for about a year and a half, and I have to tell you, it's difficult. Prior to this, I worked in criminal justice policy, and I often say that you know, it was a lot easier to decide how long somebody should be incarcerated or whether they should be out in a shorter period of time than it is to determine what we do in a classroom. It is a difficult issue that takes thoughtful people like Councillor Barth and others in elected positions to really make those tough decisions.
Ryan.
Well, my mom's a public school teacher, a lifelong public school teacher, and I think that the question here is not about what's the best form of education. Charter schools are public schools. We're talking about public schools here for the most part. Vouchers certainly creating an environment that empowers families to select the school that's best for that child. I think that is, I would think that that is the Hoosier way, and that's something that we should stand on. I actually see this as that's parents driving, asking for better choice. I think at the end of the day, it's like what Councillor Barth said, is if we focus on what are the best outcomes for the kids and be a little bit more agnostic about kind of what form that comes in and really evaluate what are the best routes to get to ensure that every Hoosier child has access to a great education. I think actually some of the partisan politics that can come into play are pushed aside. And we're seeing that here, I think, in exciting ways in Indianapolis. We're seeing that at the city council level, some really neat things are being done. Dr. Farabee is showing tremendous leadership in his creative thinking as far as helping families, all families have access to a great school, and really working in a collaborative way.
Councilor Bartho, to be fair to Kenny and her point, you know, even by your figures here, we're going to offer pre-K educational opportunities to some kids, but not to all of them. And, you know, her argument is that really every child should be afforded this opportunity. How much of that is should be government's responsibility to provide those educational opportunities to kids?
No, I absolutely agree. 100% agree. I think the greatness of our country is the opportunity for a free public education. That's what makes democracy work. When it comes specifically to the Indianapolis pre-K program, this very issue caused some people to vote against it because they didn't think we had gone far enough. But to me, at the end of the day, we ended up putting a program forward mostly through savings that is going to serve 5,000 or more kids over 5 years who wouldn't have otherwise had access to education. That to me is a good thing. It's the single thing I'm the most proud of that I've done on the council so far. And that's because it will have real results for families and for our city in the long term. So I think as elected officials, you have to make choices based on the resources that you have. As I said before, the budget, our city's billion-plus budget, is nothing other than an assemblage of priorities of the mayor and the council. And I feel really proud that we're able to put kids as one of our top priorities for 2015 and 2016 and beyond.
Yes, no answer. We're getting really tight on time to this question. I mean, in an ideal world, would it be best if government were funding all of these pre-K early childhood educational opportunities and the philanthropic dollars could be devoted to other pressing needs? I'll start with you, Ryan. Real tight.
Yeah, I think we have to find sustainable ways to provide every child pre-K.
Well, we actually have a position on that through the Early Learning Advisory Committee, and the position is that philanthropic dollars should be used as wraparound services to help encourage the support of families as they are putting their children in these high-quality programs, but government should pay the tuition for the high-quality programs.
And I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrew Cullen, John Barth, and Ryan Brady. I'd also like to thank all of our listeners and apologize to the ones whose questions we could not get on the air. This is not going to be the last time we talk about this. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.